The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
That was a summer that followed the spring. A sad anniversary of a thousand old things. I was letting them go. The words of Colette and a strange new perfume were drenching my senses and filling the room. The heat from our bodies, the light in our eyes. First a surrender and then we could fly. We were letting it go. We're blinded to the beauty in our own lives. But I was taking all I could get for 5 or 6 hours in the month of July. The summer I read Colette.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Sunday Worship with the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. Our fellowship is a principle-based, truth-seeking, justice-seeking, welcoming faith community in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. And thanks to the wonder of the internet and the skill and dedication of our fellowship tech team, John Sayre this morning, we're wherever you may be in the world today. Our minister is Reverend Andrew Weber. Reverend Andrew will be in the pulpit next Sunday for our annual in-gathering service. That service features a gathering of the water ceremony. In fact, I'm down the Jersey Shore this weekend, gathering water from the Atlantic Ocean to mingle with waters gathered by members and friends of our fellowship. You'll hear more about this gathering of water ceremony in the announcements immediately following this morning's service. I'm Jerry Lazaro, a longstanding member of the fellowship and of the Worship Committee, and on behalf of the Worship Committee and the Fellowship as a whole, I want you to know that whoever you are, wherever you may be on your spiritual journey, on your life's journey, whatever you must in conscience truly, responsibly believe, however you identify or express your gender, whomever you love, whoever loves you, you are welcome here and invited to worship with us this morning and every Sunday morning. Our service this morning is one that's become a tradition in our fellowship, a service titled Summarizing a Summer Read. In this service, we ask fellowship members to share with us their experience of reading a book that's made an impression on them and tell us what they gleaned from that book that may be of interest and value to our congregation. The service title is a bit tongue-in-cheek, because the idea of a summer read suggests to many people a book that's light and entertaining, you know, the quintessential beach book, a trendy whodunit, a breezy romance novel. But for TPUF members and friends, I think for UUs in general, not only summer, but the entire year provides opportunities to leave the beach behind and dive via books into the deep ocean waters of human thought and emotion. And I'd like to remind us that we could say that reading is central to our UU faith. Our UU community is principle-based, not creed-based. As Unitarian Universalists, we're not bound to recite a specific creed to be welcomed into this community. We're not required to sign on to a prescribed set of beliefs that are deemed forever true and unquestionable. And our commitment to those principles means that we covenant to affirm and promote principles we firmly believe can help us become more loving, more compassionate and free, and to live a more ethical, moral, meaningful, fulfilling life. But how do we come to understand our principles and more rightfully apply them? Well, we derive answers, first of all, directly through our personal experience of the world and of all the diverse, fascinating creatures that inhabit it. And we derive answers indirectly by learning of and from the experiences of others, by reading what others have spoken and written. Which leads us to the theme of this morning's service. This morning, we'll learn what several fellowship members found worthwhile in books that touched them and helped them to process their own life experiences and live a more meaningful and fulfilling life. And that's why I suspect for most, if not all of you, reading is a spiritual practice. A spiritual practice that offers unique advantages and rewards. More on this subject later in the service, because now it's time to light our chalice. My co-worship leader this morning, Renee Pidgeon, will conduct our chalice lighting. Renee?
Thank you, Jerry. The chalice and the flame together form the symbol of our free faith, signifying, among many things, our openness to the wisdom of many ages, traditions, and cultures, and our aspiration to keep the light of truth, the warmth of compassion, and the fire of commitment to freedom and justice burning within ourselves and throughout our world. This morning, let our chalice remind us of the value of opening minds and hearts to the full spectrum of human thought and experience. We're living in a time with widespread book banning initiatives that threaten to purge our libraries and bookstores, let alone our classrooms, of materials that challenge orthodox ideas and to silence the voices of marginalized people. In response, we Unitarian Universalists must renew our commitment to a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. Our chalice lighting words by UU Minister Reverend Julie Carnity affirm that commitment. We light this chalice remembering the freedoms long established by our nation: freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom from the establishment of religion. We light this chalice honoring those who exemplify protecting those freedoms: librarians, booksellers, teachers, authors, journalists. We light this chalice so that by its light, we may read all the books, books with archaic language, books with offensive material, books which affirm the diversity of the human race, books which normalize our varied sexualities, books which share multidimensional perspectives of history. May we bask in the glow of its light this morning as we illuminate, brighten, and radiate because of the books we have read and the books we have yet to read. And we're also going to light the peace lamp. May peace be with us. And now it's time to sing our gathering hymn, which reminds us of the strength of community and the gift of sharing. We search for truth, equality, and blessed peace of mind, and then we come together here to make sense of what we find. And our gathering hymn will be hymn number 354, We Live, We Die, We Laugh, We Cry.
We need to feel the song.
Our moment for all ages this morning is the Little Book of Joy. The Little Book of Joy is an offspring of the Book of Joy. The Book of Joy chronicles a week-long celebration in April 2015 of the 80th birthday of Tenzin Gyatso, His Holiness, the 14th Dalai Lama. South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu was invited to participate in the Dalai Lama's birthday party. And the theme of the Dalai Lama's week-long birthday celebration was joy. And throughout the week, these two spiritual leaders and steadfast friends engaged in discussions and interviews on the nature and practice of joy and the challenges we face in living a joyful life. So as a message for all ages this morning, I'd like to share with you all the Little Book of Joy. I'll also take the opportunity to introduce our youngest fellowship members to these remarkable leaders. Our more mature members may welcome the opportunity to renew acquaintance with these spiritual guides in the universal search for happiness and for happiness in life. Okay, let's see here. Do we have the slideshow going? I can't see. John, are you there? Okay, we got it. Okay, all right. His Holiness, the 14th Dalai Lama, Tenzin Gyatso, is the spiritual leader of the Tibetan people and of Tibetan Buddhism. He was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1989. And the U.S. Congressional Gold Medal in 2007. The Dalai Lama has traveled the world to promote kindness and compassion, interfaith understanding, and protection of Tibetan culture, and respect for the environment, and above all, deeper human values based on our sense of the oneness of humanity with the aim of creating a more compassionate society. He has lived in exile in Dharamshala, India, since 1959. Desmond Mpilo Tutu, Archbishop Emeritus of Southern Africa, was a prominent leader in the crusade for justice and reconciliation in South Africa. He was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1984 and the Presidential Medal of Honor in 2009. After South Africa's transition to democracy in 1994, he was appointed chair of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where he pioneered a new way for countries to move forward after experiencing civil conflict and oppression. Archbishop Tutu is regarded as a leading moral voice and an icon of hope, I should say was, because fortunately he passed away about 5 years ago. See, next slide. Okay. One of us grew up in a little house. And one of us grew up in a big house. I want to take a moment here, though, because to put a little bit in context for us, when the young Dalai Lama there is talking about growing up in a big house, just what is he talking about? Well, I have a slide here to show you the Potala Palace, This is where he lived prior to having to escape Tibet and flee to India. And I don't know if you can get a sense from looking at this how big this is. Let me see, how many rooms do you have in the house that you live in? Maybe 7 or 8, maybe a few more, maybe 10, if you have a little big house. Well, how many rooms do you think are in this Potala Palace? What if I told you there were 10,000 rooms? Can you kind of process that? All right. And in that particular space, right, it's 13 stories high. It contains over, I'm sorry, 1,000 rooms, not 10,000. It contains 10,000 shrines and about 200,000 statues. And when you think about the area of the home that you live in, how many square feet is how we kind of measure that. I think my house has about 2,300 square feet, right? Anyone have a flying guess as to what the inside area of the Potala Palace is? It's almost 4 million square feet. So we're talking about a big house. Okay, back to the story. And you notice that they lived on opposite sides of the world. The Dalai Lama, you can see in the mountains of Tibet on your far right, and Archbishop Desmond Tutu way down in the Cape of Africa, in South Africa, right? And this is their story. So often, they say, we were sad and lonely. Both of us wished for a friend. Next slide. Sometimes the other kids wouldn't let us play, or they were very far away. We wondered if we would always be sad and lonely. But when we sat still and breathed in the quiet, we noticed something beautiful. If you just focus on the thing that is making you sad, then the sadness is all you see. But if you look around, you will see that joy is everywhere. Joy is in the warm, tingly feeling of the sun tickling your toes in the morning. It's the giggly, squiggly feeling when you're doing something silly. And it's the soft, snuggly feeling of being all wrapped up cozy in your bed at night. Even when you get caught in the rain and your joy is washed away, it's waiting for you in the bottom of a puddle. Even if you slam the door and your joy can't get in, it's just on the other side, waiting in a loving hug. Sometimes if there's a loud noise in the night and your joy gets scared away, it comes streaming back with the light of the silvery moon. Joy is the bubbly, bouncy feeling of finding a good friend. And when you feel that joy, like magic, your heart always has room for more. We discovered that the more joy we shared, the more joy we had. And the more joy we had, the more joy we could share. So look for the joy all around you and share it. Write it in a letter. Play it on a drum. Sing it to the sky. Send it up into the air. It will travel. up in the air across the ocean, someone will find it and share it. And as it spreads from person to person, the world will be filled with joy. There's just a little note in the book that the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Tutu included. He said, "We have traveled all around the world and met many wonderful children. Unfortunately, we cannot meet everyone. So we wanted to say hello and share this story with you. We wrote this book to help you remember that even when you are feeling, when you are having a hard time, joy is never far away. Sometimes we get sad, sometimes we get angry, sometimes we get scared. But after the rain and the storms, we have found there is often a rainbow. We hope you will find joy and rainbows in the pages of this book, and that you can share that joy with the people you know. This is the secret of joy we discovered together. The more joy we share, the more joy we have." Do we have some children in the sanctuary this morning? Do we want to sing them off? John?
No, we don't have any children today, so...
All right, then we don't need to sing hymn number 413. And so I guess we'll go right to back to Renee, who will help introduce our speakers this morning, right?
Before several fellowship members share with us their experience of reading books that touch their lives, I'd like to put into context how this morning's service attests to our UU faith and rightfully qualifies as a spiritual practice. Did you know that the Quran, the textual pillar of Islam, refers to Christians and Jews as people of the book? Why? Because of the role that one single book, the only book deemed definitive and sacred, is required to play in their lives. That's a quote by Susan Van Zanten. Well, as we UUs could aptly label ourselves people of the books, plural, our written sources of knowledge and wisdom are far-ranging and far-reaching. Writings from all the world's religions, including earth-centered traditions, not just from Jewish and Christian teachings, and writings from the humanist tradition, from philosophy, history, literature, from the sciences. And we find enrichment and inspiration in a great work of fiction or nonfiction, or a passage from a great poem, in a Buddhist tale or a Native American prayer, or a treatise of the latest discoveries of quantum physics or on the origins of the universe, just as enriched and inspired as we may be by a passage from the so-called good book, in most cases, I would venture to say, much more likely. For me, one of the most appealing features of Unitarian Universalism is that it doesn't demand that we rely on just one book to nurture spiritual growth. It doesn't imprison our spirit between the covers of just one book produced in one culture, in one language, in one chapter of human history. And so we UUs keep on reading. I've spoken with many, many UUs who attest to the importance of certain books in their lives, and I've never heard one UU say that they ever needed or wanted to say that all they ever needed or wanted to know was contained in just one book. You know, scientific research testifies to the many benefits of reading, from lowering blood pressure and reducing stress to increasing motivation, from mitigating depression and narcissism to preventing dementia and cultivating empathy. But one benefit, I think, stands above all others. Reading connects us not only with ourselves, but with others. Others we might not otherwise even know about, let alone come to know as if they were family members or cherished friends. Maya Angelou once wrote, "If I were a young person today, trying to gain a sense of myself in the world, I would do that again by reading, just as I did when I was young. And Virginia Woolf claimed, "Reading allows us to slip involuntarily, often helplessly, into another's skin, another's voice, another's soul." That's why I truly responsibly believe that reading, particularly reading well what is well worth reading, is a spiritual practice. So I'm eager to learn what readers Deb Murata, Marianne Gorman, and Gina Mastrangeli have learned from books they found worth reading. So now, in that order, I'll turn the service over to them.
When I first picked up Sybil Exposed by Debbie Nathan, I thought I knew the subject. The cultural image of Sybil, the woman with many personalities, was already famous. Debbie Nathan dismantles this familiar tale, showing how Sybil's doctor fed her addictive narcotics that left her confused, prone to hallucinations and false memories, and built a sensationalized account of abuse. How many of us who read the original Sybil or saw the TV movie with Sally Field simply accepted the idea without question that part of the brain represses bad memories that only a psychiatrist can uncover through hypnosis and drugs? How many of us would be shocked to find out that Flora Retta Schreiber, the author who brought Sybil's story to the public, exaggerated events and made false claims, creating a story that was more marketable than truthful? Sybil's true medical condition was pernicious anemia, a serious but treatable illness. Untreated, it can cause many issues, including problems with balance, memory loss, confusion, mood changes, and hallucinations or paranoia. Instead of getting the help she truly needed, and at one point dismissing a treatment that was working, she became so bound to her psychiatrist, Dr. Cornelia Wilbur, that she set aside her whole life. Shirley Mason, that's Sybil's real name, could have moved away and become an art teacher or an art therapist. Instead, as Debbie Nathan writes, she languished in therapy for years, giving up her independence and self-trust. This learned helplessness, the slow loss of your ability to act for yourself until your own voice becomes impossible to find, that resonated with me. There are moments in life when we let someone else's voice grow louder than our own. Sometimes it's out of love, sometimes fear of moving out of our comfort zones, sometimes just wanting approval. Then, without realizing, our passions, the things that make us who we are, get set aside. Then I've had those moments when I followed so closely in another's shadow that my own shape nearly disappeared. I believed their vision for me was the correct vision, or safer than my own. It took me years to recognize what I had set down, to realize I'd allowed others to make important decisions for me. Sybil Exposed isn't just an in-depth analysis. For me, it's a cautionary tale. A reminder that admiration, coupled with a lack of self-awareness, should never turn into surrender, that guidance should never cost us our own voice. Leaving your comfort zone isn't easy, especially when someone you trust helped shape it. But if you don't take that step, you may never find out who you could really become. I hold Debbie Nathan's expose clearly, closely, as a quiet warning. Follow wisely. Listen carefully, especially if something doesn't feel right. Know yourself, and don't hand that power to anyone else.
Good morning. I finished Stoner by John Williams a couple of weeks ago for another book club. And I was so moved by it that I just had to share it with you. First of all, Stoner is not about what you think it's about. It's about a farm boy turned English professor named Stoner. His lifespan fell across two world wars, although he fought in neither. I just love the painting on the cover. It's The Thinker, Portrait of Lewis N. Kenton by Thomas Aikens. He's a Philadelphia artist you may know from his phenomenal work shown in the Philadelphia Museum of Art. I love Aikens' work because, like this one, it's full, I love Aikens' work because, like this one, it's full of empathy for its subjects. And the same can be said about this book. The author, John Williams, not the composer of the Star Wars music, a professor himself, published Stoner in 1965. Williams is not particularly well known among classic authors, although he did win a U.S. National Book Award in 1972 for another book. Stoner was a modest seller in the 1960s and somehow gained popularity around 2013. Tom Hanks, of all people, mentioned it as a book he loved, and the New Yorker called it the greatest American novel you've never heard of. This is a simple story about a man of few achievements. The book starts with the report of his death in 1956. This is a quote from the book. Few students remembered him with any sharpness after they had taken his classes. Stoner's colleagues, who held him in no particular esteem when he was alive, speak of him rarely now. To the younger ones, Stoner's name is merely a sound, which evokes no sense of the past and no identity with which they can associate themselves or their careers. Why would I tell you to read a book about this guy? Well, let's get back to that empathy that I mentioned in the Aikens paintings. As the book goes on, you begin to feel Williams' great empathy for this unremarkable man who develops a deep love for literature that he is rarely able to express fully to his students or to write about. The feeling I get from this book is about opacity and translucence. Stoner begins as a dutiful farm boy who barely sees the world beyond himself, who barely sees himself. He's within a shroud until he attends college and an English professor questions him about a work. Mr. Shakespeare speaks to you across 300 years, Mr. Stoner. Do you hear him? William Stoner looked about the room. Light slanted from the window and settled upon the faces of his fellow students so that the illumination seemed to come from within them and go out against the dimness. A student blinked, and a thin shadow fell upon a cheek whose down had caught the sunlight. Stoner turned his hands about under his gaze, marveling at their brownness. He thought he could feel the blood flowing invisibly through the tiny veins and arteries, throbbing delicately and precariously from his fingertips through his body. So after opening to the world around him like this in the class, Stoner, he can't answer the professor's questions at all. But that deep feeling he has about literature that he can barely express grows very slowly to his feelings for other people and eventually himself as a human. It's no spoiler after how the novel began that, surprise, he dies in the end. And the description of Stoner's own experience of dying from within fills some of the most beautiful pages I've ever read. As he dissolves, he finally becomes translucent, open to all the reality around him. I know this sounds pretty depressing, but I recommend it with all my heart. It's truly a beautiful novel, written by an author with infinite respect for his main character, who is human in the way most of us are. Flawed, often helpless in the face of circumstance, and full of a sensitivity others can't see.
Good morning. I have a confession. I didn't read this book this summer. I read it several years ago. But it's a book that lingers in my psyche, and from time to time it surfaces when I'm in the middle of a thought-provoking, deep conversation, soul-searching discussion. So first of all, this has been a popular book. How many of you have read it? Okay, how many of you have seen the movie? Okay, the movie's okay, but the book is what challenges the reader to reflect and consider new perspectives. So first, some background information about the author. Brian Stevenson founded the Equal Justice Initiative, a nonprofit organization based in Montgomery, Alabama, that provides free legal assistance to low-income prisoners and guarantees legal representation to any prisoner on Alabama's death row. The book focuses on Stevenson's efforts to overturn the wrongful conviction of Walter McMillan, a man who was sentenced to death for murder he did not commit. So need I mention, he was poor, black, and living in a state, at least from our perspective, that has less than a glorious history in race relations. But the book just isn't about Walter. In alternate chapters, Stevenson weaves in stories that highlight the disparities in our justice system regarding poverty, race, mental health, and children. So the obvious theme here is a powerful call to conscience, a plea for social justice, and the abolition of the death penalty. But even more than that, Stevenson invites us to wrestle with moving issues about mercy and justice and raises questions that are thought-provoking and uncomfortable. So let me share one story that tackles mental health in our justice system. Stevenson received a phone call from an inmate on death row. His name was Avery Jenkins. Avery was so incoherent on the phone that Stevenson needed to meet with him in person. So he drove to the prison, and sitting in the parking lot was a pickup truck pasted with menacing racist bumper stickers and decals, a Confederate flag, and a gun rack. My apologies to the hunters. That's just the description of the pickup truck. Inside the prison, a hostile correction officer insisted that Stevenson be strip searched and that he sign superfluous forms not required for an attorney. He also made it clear the Confederate decorated pickup truck was his. So this is where the movie stops, but there is so much more to the story. When Stevenson met Avery, Avery's first words were, "Did you bring me a chocolate milkshake? I want a chocolate milkshake." Flustered, especially after that morning, Stevenson explained that the authorities would not allow him to bring food into their meetings. And that conversation became a ritual. Every time they met, Avery began with, "Did you bring me the milkshake?" And Stevenson had to explain that he could not bring a milkshake into their meetings. So Avery's history is this. His father had been murdered before he was born. His mother died of an overdose when he was one. He bounced from foster home to foster home, where he suffered abuse of all kinds, physical, sexual, emotional. He was denied food and locked in closets. One foster mother tied him to a tree and left him there. Hunters found him, the book says, 3 days later, but maybe it was a day, and untied him. At an early age, Avery showed signs of brain damage, intellectual disabilities, and serious mental health issues. So by the time he was in his late teens, he was homeless, abusing alcohol and drugs, in and out of jail, and experiencing seizures and psychotic episodes. At age 20, during a psychotic episode, Avery wandered into a home of an elderly man. Now, believing that this man was a demon, he brutally stabbed him to death. At Avery's trial, there was no investigation into his mental health history. Avery was convicted of murder and sentenced to death. At the trial, the hostile correction officer accompanied Avery. And because Stevenson was concerned, after the trial, he returned to the prison to ensure that Avery had been treated properly. But this time, the officer warmly greeted him with the appropriate forms already signed. And then he told Stevenson, just as he was about to enter into his meeting with Avery, that he appreciated what he was doing for Avery. He was doing a good deed. And then he explained, "I was in foster homes, in foster care, and I thought no one had it tougher than I did. But now I know that some people had it worse. Thank you for what you're doing for Avery." And then he added, "On the way back from the trial, I stopped at Wendy's and bought Avery a chocolate milkshake." So now let's just pause and think about that. And what about in your own life? Have you ever had a moment like that? Something that changed you? Changed how you thought about something or how you approached life? Do you know anybody who has? And if so, what sparked that transforming moment? As for Avery, he's no longer on death row and in a facility where he's receiving mental health treatment. Okay, so Stevenson, I told you a story, does more than feed us emotional stories about people's lives. He also gives us facts. He dives into the history of how we have treated mental illness in this country. I guess Roz should be here. And the resulting effect on our legal system. He details historical abuses in the mental health facilities that brought forth change, community health programs, and personal empowerment for the mentally ill. Yet, with that came the right for a mentally ill person to refuse treatment, which has led to more homelessness, drug abuse, and crime. Concurrently, harsher sentencing laws have filled our prisons with the mentally ill. So this book has everything: a description of our legal justice system, its flaws and failures, an examination of America's struggle with racism and poverty, and evocative stories of people most likely you have never met, may never meet. And while I was reading it, I kept wondering, how does Stevenson keep fighting for justice when he faced and is facing challenges of race and money for his organization, corruption, bomb threats, and failure? Near the end of the book, he shares a story from his childhood which explains it. And you might want to read the book to learn the story. But the message is in the title, Just Mercy. And so we all might have different interpretations of what that means. So let's just begin with a definition. According to one dictionary, mercy is compassion or forgiveness shown towards someone whom it is with one's power to punish or harm. Just means fair, morally correct, deserved. So combining those definitions, just mercy means deserved compassion or forgiveness shown towards someone whom it is within your power to punish or harm. But keeping that in mind, that concept, just mercy, Avery's case might seem easier to accept. He's off death row and getting treatment. But what if the victim had been your parent, your spouse, or your child who had been brutally stabbed to death? And what about in your everyday life when someone has injured or wronged you? When it becomes personal, mercy becomes more difficult. And how do we express mercy with justice? So I'm going to conclude. These are just questions that I have. I don't know the answers. So I'm going to conclude with another thought about mercy that Brian Stevenson poses in his book. There is a strength, a power even, in understanding brokenness, because embracing our brokenness creates a need and a desire for mercy, and perhaps a corresponding need to show mercy. When you experience mercy, you learn things that are hard to learn otherwise. You see things you can't otherwise see. You hear things you can't otherwise hear. You begin to recognize the humanity that resides in each of us. A little different from Jerry's introduction.
We come together from the multitude of our lives, and we bring with ourselves the pain, the joy, the laughter, and tears in our hearts. It is right and it is holy to bring our entire selves into this place. If you have highs or lows which you feel moved to share, I invite you to come forward and share briefly. If online, you may raise your physical or virtual hand or type in the chat. Please start with your name. Thank you.
We will bring this time of sharing to a close. As we typically do, we're going to sing Spirit of Life, and the lyrics and video will show up on your screens in just a second.
Hi, everyone. I'm back. Before we extinguish our chalice, I wanted to say a few words here. But one thing is, as I was working with Renee on this service, I mentioned to her that there's always this apprehension sometimes here because you're turning over the service to members of our congregation to provide the core of the message for the service. And what I found, I told her, was that anytime I do that, I'm just not just delighted, but kind of overwhelmed. It reminds me of why I come to this congregation, why I keep coming back, because I know that I'm surrounded with people who are deeply caring and who have concern about not just themselves, but about the fate of others in the world, and people who realize that life is a long learning process, and learning is a lifelong process. They're always, always engaged in that, what we call the responsible search for truth and meaning. And when we have an opportunity like we had this morning for fellow members of our congregation to share some of what they've learned, it's just remarkable. I mean, Deb, Marianne, and Gina, thank you so much. I just... was thoroughly imbued with everything that you were saying this morning. Wonderful. So let's now join in honoring the source of faith and learning by singing hymn number 58, Praise the Source of Faith and Learning. This morning's closing song features words by 19th century Universalist minister Samuel Longfellow. He was an accomplished writer as well as minister, but his achievements as a writer were rather overshadowed by those of his brother, the widely popular and world-famous poet Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. Now, be that as it may, no less than 9 songs in our gray hymnal feature lyrics by Samuel Longfellow. It seems that his writing strikes a chord, pardon the pun, with UUs. And among those songs is hymn number 345, With Joy We Claim the Growing Light. The Community Unitarian Universalist Congregation of White Plains, New York, will lead us in singing With Joy We Claim the Growing Light. Please stand in body or spirit as you're willing and able to claim and proclaim the growing light. I leave you this morning with words by novelist, progressive activist, and speaker Anne Lamott. What a miracle it is, she writes, that out of these small, flat, rigid squares of paper unfolds world after world after world, worlds that sing to you, comfort and quiet, or excite you. Books help us understand who we are and how we are to behave. They show us what community and friendship mean. They show us how to live and die. And I know I've shared this nugget of wisdom with you before, but I leave you with one of my favorite insights into the world of books by that great literary critic and philosopher, Groucho Marx. Outside of a dog, Groucho opined, a book is man's best friend. Inside of a dog, it's too dark to read. And now we'll extinguish our chalice with Renee's help, but not the light of compassion, not the warmth of compassion, the light of truth, or the commitment we have to freedom and justice. Let us take those affirmations with us into the world and share them with those whose lives we touch and whose lives touch our own. Please stay with us for announcements, and I believe we have a book discussion to follow the service this morning.